Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Dion Gordon Podcast. I'm your host, the connoisseur of common sense, the purveyor of authenticity, the man who calls it right down the middle, Dion Tyree Gordon. Enough of the bullshit. Let's get to work. Two game sevens today in the NBA playoffs. The Phoenix Suns hosting the Dallas Mavericks. The 64-win Phoenix Suns, I should say, hosting the Dallas Mavericks in the game seven. And the Boston Celtics hosting your defending NBA champion Milwaukee Bucks in a pivotal winner-take-all sudden-death Game 7. Who would have thought that on the same day, the two participants in last year's NBA Finals would lose in the semifinals by a combined total of 61 points? Milwaukee lost 123-90 to the Boston Celtics. The Phoenix Suns, the 64-win Phoenix Suns, a team that made it to last year's NBA final and had a 2-0 series lead against the Milwaukee Bucks, came back this season on a mission with a purpose to not only get back to the NBA Finals, but this time win it. And they lost in the second round after compiling 64 wins in the regular season, the best record in all the National Basketball Association, the only team in the NBA to win 60 games, and they don't even reach the conference final, and they lose Game 7 at home by 28 points. What's a complete disaster? I guess I'll get started on this NBA playoff semifinal recap podcast talking about the most recent game I just watched. I just witnessed this. The game just ended. The Phoenix Suns and the Dallas Mavericks, Dallas 109, Phoenix 81. And I see a lot of people online slandering Chris Paul for this loss, and no doubt about it, Chris Paul did not play well. 31 minutes played, 4 for 8 from the field, 1 for 3 from 3, 1 rebound, 4 assists, 3 fouls, and 10 points. In Game 7, the point guard was non-existent. The point guard has not looked himself ever since Game 2 of this series. Going back to the first round series against the New Orleans Pelicans, he looked washed. He looked tired. He looked fatigued. Jose Alvarado wore him down, picking him up 94 feet full court. CP3 didn't appear to be himself after Game 2 of this series. It looked like once he turned 37, it just all went to shit. Like as soon as he blew out the candles on his birthday cake, he just forgot how to play basketball or just couldn't physically do it anymore. Because after Game 2, for the rest of this series, Chris Paul was a non-factor. Let's call it what it is. He is one of the greatest point guards who ever played basketball. But in this series, after Game 2, completely worthless. Completely worthless. This is the fifth time in his career, by the way. He has lost a series despite being up 2-0. You go back to last year's NBA Finals, Phoenix was up 2-0 against the Milwaukee Bucks. It happened to him with the Clippers. It happened to him with New Orleans when he was there. He's done this at multiple stages of his career. He's been a part of teams that have blown 2-0 series leads. But at this stage of his career, at 37, with the amount of basketball he's played and with the teammates that he has, I'm not going to hold this 100% against Chris Paul. I'll give him 20% of the blame. The majority of the blame, in my opinion, should go in the direction of DeAndre Ayton and Devin Booker, who combined for 16 points. Two of these guys, two all-star players, combined for 16 points. Both guys in their prime, both guys in their mid-20s. In Game 7 at home, winner take all sudden death, and you combine to give me 16 points? All the Chris Paul slander to me is out of pocket. Chris Paul is 37. He should not be the best player on this team. That regard should go to either Devin Booker or DeAndre Ayton. Devin Booker shows up in a Game 7 at home and goes 3 for 14, 0 for 4 from the three-point range, 3 rebounds, 2 assists, 3 fouls, 11 points. Game 7, winner take all. The guy who a lot of people compare to Kobe Bryant, a lot of people disrespectfully compare to our late great ancestor, Kobe Bean Bryant, and call him the next Kobe, the second coming of Kobe. He's got some Black Mamba in this game. Where the fuck is the Black Mamba in Devin Booker, or I should say Devin Jenner's game? That's how he played tonight. He didn't play like Devin Booker. He played like Devin Jenner. That was a Kardashian performance out there. 3 for 14, 0 for 4 from 3, 11 points in a closeout game in a game 7, which was season on the line. That's the best you can do? And you're supposed to be the next Kobe? You're supposed to be the modern-day Kobe Bryant. The only way Devin Booker could be Kobe Bryant is if he died and got reincarnated. It's impossible. You will never see another Kobe Bean Bryant. The level of disrespect leveled towards that man, even in death, is preposterous. Devin Booker's a nice basketball player, but to assert that he's the next Kobe Bryant, no. That's too much. That's audacious. That's disrespectful. 3 for 14 and 11 points at home. 64-win team against a team you should have beaten. And I know people will say, well, Devin Booker had a hamstring injury. It's the playoffs. Everyone's hurt this time of year. Everyone's banged up. No one is really at 100% right now. DeAndre Ayton, same thing. DeAndre Ayton's in the contract year. His contract is up, as a matter of fact. He should be. He's probably going to be a free agent. Barkley and Shaq were both in agreement that Phoenix should re-sign him. You can't possibly lose a guy like DeAndre Ayton. Kenny Smith also agreed with that. All three former players on the panel agree with the fact that you cannot possibly lose DeAndre Ayton if you're the Phoenix Suns. He's going to go to a rival team in the Western Conference and make them better, at the same time hurt the Phoenix Suns. DeAndre Ayton tonight had 5 points in 17 minutes. Should people really be on television advocating for him right now? Should people really be on television talking about how the Phoenix Suns can't possibly lose him? What the fuck did he contribute tonight? 5 points in 17 minutes. You mean to tell me the Phoenix Suns can't do without that? You need better than that. You're the former number one pick in the 2018 draft. You know who's the number 3 pick in that draft? Luka Doncic of the Dallas Mavericks, who tonight beat earth, wind, fire, ice, hail, rain, sleet, and snow out of the Phoenix Suns. That was ugly. That was No Limit sneakers ugly tonight, what you saw in Phoenix. They got their asses handed to them. They got beat down and broken down to the very last compound. See how it sounds a little irrational? A lot of MCs like to use the word dramatical. Fresh for 88, you suckers. Luka Doncic fucking destroyed the Phoenix Suns tonight. I'm going to go ahead and say it right now. The two best basketball players on the planet, in the NBA or anywhere, the two best basketball players in the whole entire world are European white dudes. Luka Doncic and Nikola Jokic, those are the two best basketball players on this planet, European white dudes. As a black man, it kind of hurts me to say that, but as a person who at the beginning of every podcast calls himself the purveyor of authenticity and the man who calls it right down the middle, I cannot be delinquent in my truth-telling abilities right now. The two best basketball players on this earth are European white dudes, Luka Doncic and Nikola Jokic. Luka Doncic tonight had 35 points, 12 of 19 from the field, 6 of 11 from 3, 10 rebounds, 4 assists, 3 fouls. Here's the thing about Luka. He plays with pace, under complete control. He's in full control of what he's doing on the court. He's going to get to his spot. He's going to move you off of your spot. He can hit a step back 3. He can hit a pull-up jumper for 2. He can drive to the basket. It doesn't matter. He's playing at his own pace, under complete control. Not even the most athletic guy you've ever seen. He's a big motherfucker, 6'7", 230. No real muscle tone in his body, but he's strong as hell. He moves other grown men off their spots, and you can't stop him from getting to his spot. He can handle the basketball. He can shoot from distance. He can bully his way to the paint, as I just said. There's really no answer for him one-on-one. And what he's able to do is able to free up the other guys around him, Jalen Brunson, Spencer Dinwiddie, guys like that, Dorian Finney-Smith. He's able to free them up to be able to excel at a higher level than those guys are normally accustomed to. Jalen Brunson's been kicking ass. Jalen Brunson was on the court, the smallest man on the floor, bullying people, moving guys out the way, getting positioned for rebounds. This is a different NBA. This is a much different NBA right now than guys in my age bracket are accustomed to. If you're 37 like me, or somewhere a little bit older, or a little bit younger, you're not used to seeing a guy like Jalen Brunson dominate in the paint. you're not used to seeing a guy back people down in the post the way he does. I mean, it's a different game, but it all starts with Luka Doncic right now for Dallas. It starts and ends with him. And he is a guy, like I said, in my estimation, top two in the NBA right now. This is a guy who coming into this game was averaging 39 points a game in game sevens. The most important, pivotal, crucial time of the year. Your best players got to operate at their highest level. And Luka Doncic does exactly that. 39 points per game coming into game sevens into today. And then he puts up 35. Just an absolutely incredible performance. That was virtuoso, as some people might say. That was everything you want your star player to do. He did everything right. It was perfect. Perfect performance by Luka Doncic. And the Dallas Mavericks were dominant. They were up by 30 points at halftime. They had a lead as large as 42 in this game. The Suns were never in this game. They never had a lead. The Phoenix Suns never had a lead. This team had the best record in pro basketball this season. Had game seven at home. Did not have a lead for the entire game. The Dallas Mavericks, nobody thought Dallas could make it this far to the conference finals. People looked at Dallas as a one-man team, Luka Doncic and a couple of other dudes. And yet here they are in the conference finals after choke-slamming the Phoenix Suns through a table, a flaming table covered in barbed wire and thumbtacks. Out of a balcony, Luka Doncic picked up Chris Paul and threw him out of a balcony through a flaming table covered in barbed wire, thumbtacks, and plexiglass. Two tables stacked up on top of each other. This was an absolute annihilation. This game was never in doubt. I remember after game six telling people, hey, Phoenix is going to win or lose this game based on what Devin Booker does. Devin Booker was non-existent the entire series. As I said earlier, you can talk about his hamstring problems. As I also said, this time of year, everyone's banged up, everyone's hurt. Devin Booker had to have a great game tonight, and he didn't. That was Devin Jenner. Devin Jenner went out there and shit the bed tonight. He played like Kendall tonight. All these guys get affiliated. When are people going to learn? When are people going to absolutely understand this? That when you get affiliated with the Jenner Kardashian family, you're going to suffer. Your performance and whatever your chosen profession is, if it's usually sports. They have a tendency to date a lot of athletes. Whenever you get affiliated with these evil women, your performance will suffer, will drop dramatically. Devin Booker, Devin Jenner, Ben Simmons, Miles Austin, Chris Humphries, Lamar Odom, whatever. They have a habit of dating athletes, and they also have a habit of fucking these athletes up and ruining their careers and their lives. Devin Booker is just the latest casualty of this. He played basketball in a very light-skinned fashion tonight. That was light-skinned basketball at his best, just soft and lame and weak and emaciated and emasculated. Malnourished, malnutrition, all the above. That was soft, weak, pathetic basketball by Devin Jenner tonight. All this talk about Chris Paul, he's not in his prime, and he's not the most talented player on his team. Devin Booker should have led that team tonight. I refuse to accept or hear otherwise. A lot of people just don't like Chris Paul and just hate Chris Paul for whatever reason. Whether he flops too much or he talks too much shit or he's arrogant or whatever the perception of him might be. Make no mistake about it. I'm a Chris Paul fan. As I said earlier, when he was 36, he was still Chris Paul. Once he turned 37, he became Cliff Paul. The way he played tonight, he should probably be selling insurance. But to me, the bulk of the blame should not go in his direction. It should go to Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton, the two younger players on the team and two guys who are more talented than Chris Paul. Y'all should have been the leaders for this game tonight. You weren't. Luka Doncic was. He was everything a superstar basketball player is supposed to be in a game seven. And as a result, his team is moving on and the Phoenix Suns are making reservations for Cancun, Saint-Tropez, the Virgin Islands, Hawaii, fill in the blank, wherever the fuck. Point is, they're going on vacation. The Phoenix Suns scored 10 points, 10, in the second quarter of this basketball game. This game was played at the Phoenix Suns home arena, known as the Footprint Center. How apropos, because the Dallas Mavericks put hands, feet, and footprints all over the Phoenix Suns in tonight's game. The game was sponsored by Clorox. Once again, how appropriate, because the Phoenix Suns got washed. out there tonight in Game 7 of this Western Conference semifinal series against the Dallas Mavericks. That was as ugly as it possibly could get. It was embarrassing. Just an absolutely brutal loss for your defending Western Conference champion Phoenix Suns. There will be two new teams in this year's NBA final. The other participant in last year's NBA final, who also played in Game 7 today, the Milwaukee Bucks, got blasted on the road by the Boston Celtics, 109-81, and it wasn't even that close. This game was also no limit sneakers ugly. Here's what you need to know about this game. This game defied all logic and all conventional basketball wisdom. Because typically, when you're approaching a basketball game, or the way people in my generation have been taught, this game made no sense, but it makes perfect sense when you think about modern-day basketball and the way the game is played and the way the game is going to be played for the foreseeable future. Basketball in 2022 is all about making the three-point shot. The amount of threes you take doesn't matter. You can take 100 for all that matters. The new analytical approach to the game of basketball, it rewards teams who take a lot of three-point shots. If you can make a lot of three-point shots, you have a good chance of winning a basketball game. This is 2022. It's a different era right now. And to prove that, look at the box score for this Bucks-Celtics game today. Basketball in 2022 is all about making a three-point shot. As I said, evidence of this, Exhibit A, the Milwaukee Bucks went 4-for-33 from three-point range in Game 7 today. The Boston Celtics went 22-of-55. A basketball team attempted 55 threes. The losing team attempted 33. There were 88 three-point shots taken in this basketball game, but the team that made 40% of their three-point attempts won the game. The team that made 12.1 of their attempts lost the game. Despite the fact that the Milwaukee Bucks out-rebounded the Boston Celtics 56-48. The Milwaukee Bucks scored more points in the fast break in transition, 17-8. They outscored them in points in the paint, 48-26. But despite all that, fuck all of that. It means nothing. It's completely irrelevant. You win basketball games today by the three-point jump shot. And when you make 40% and shoot 22-55, you can overcome the disparity in points in the paint and rebounding and points in transition. It doesn't matter. You made 22 threes. That's 66 points right there. 66 out of the 109 that Boston scored from behind the arc. Milwaukee, 4-for-33. You missed 29 three-point shots in this game. The next thing I'm about to say is going to sound completely ridiculous, utterly preposterous, and flat-out ridiculous. But Giannis Antetokounmpo struggled, had a bad game, had an off night. Now, Giannis Antetokounmpo tonight played 43 minutes of basketball, was 10 of 26 from the field, 1-for-4 from 3. He had 20 rebounds in this game and scored 25 points and had 9 assists. I just said that a guy had a bad game going 25-20-9. But those, I mean, Giannis has set a higher level of standard and expectation for himself. So those numbers, as lofty as they are, coming in a game where you lost by 28 points, you had a bad game. And it's, I'll be the first one to tell you, it sounds preposterous for me to even say this out loud, but Giannis Antetokounmpo had a bad game. He missed a lot of layups, a lot of bunnies, a lot of floaters at the rim, shots he normally makes. He had a bad game. Part of the reason why he had a bad game, though, there was nothing around him. You saw in this series what the absence of Chris Middleton means to the Milwaukee Bucks. He spreads the floor. He's a capable outside shooter. He makes it easier for Giannis to do his thing. The defense can't just focus 100% of their attention on Giannis when Chris Middleton's out on the floor. So in his absence, Giannis's job becomes that much more difficult. Without Chris Middleton, now you got to depend on the man who's been the winner of the Ted Cruz lookalike contest for the past 5 years, Grayson Allen, this low-life, dirty-playing scumbag from Duke University. Now you got to depend on guys like him. And he missed 12 of his last 13 shots, his last two games of this series, games 6 and 7. And he was also barbecue chicken on defense. Pat Connaughton missed 5 of 6 shots in game 7. Wesley Matthews had one bucket. That was it. The Bucks had the third best offense in the NBA this season. Only two times where they held below 90 points. That happened twice in this series versus the Boston Celtics without Chris Middleton. Al Horford came to life in this series. Al Horford, an elder statesman of the league, a veteran, a guy who's been around for a long time, 35 years of age or about to turn 35, and he turned back the clock in this series. He played at a high level. Without Al Horford, the Boston Celtics don't win this series. Point blank, period. I would go as far as to say that Al Horford was the second best player for Boston in this series, even better than Jaylen Brown. Tatum's your number one guy, but I would say Horford in particular. Look what Horford did in game 4 to knock that series up in two games. Going back to Boston, Milwaukee won game 5. Boston took game 6 and 7. But in game 4, when they're down 2-1, a pivotal game, Al Horford was the guy who rose to the occasion on both ends of the floor, defending Giannis and also getting timely buckets. The Boston Celtics do not win this series without Al Horford. You can't even measure how important he was to what Boston was able to accomplish in this series. He was everything. However, in Game 7, with all the talk about Horford and Tatum and Jaylen Brown, as great as those players are, Grant Williams, of all people, rose to the occasion and had 27 points to lead all scorers in this game from both teams. He was the leading scorer in this game, 27 points, 7 of 18 from 3. Grant Williams found himself wide open all game long, corner threes, left and right. Tatum taking up much of the attention from the Milwaukee defense or Jaylen Brown. Drive, penetrate, kick out to the perimeter. Grant Williams, wide the fuck open, bury the three. Do your job. Play good defense and hit wide open threes. Do your job, as Bill Belichick would say. Do your job. And that's exactly what Grant Williams did. And as a result, Boston's moving on, Milwaukee staying behind. You have to ask the question, was last year's NBA Finals a fluke? For both teams. Both teams lost on the same calendar day, and both teams were eliminated on the same calendar day. Who made the NBA Finals a season ago? And now here they are, not even able to get past the semifinals. I mean, a lot of people, myself included, question what happened in 2020, question the validity of what happened in 2020, the legitimacy of that NBA Finals in the bubble sponsored by George Floyd and Disney and Black Lives Matter. A lot of people question that NBA Finals series, but what about last season too? Same thing, condensed season, 66 games. Season got started a little bit later. You played all the way into July. You know, everyone's still trying to recover from the pandemic. Everything is a little bit off balance. Now you got a rushed, hurried up NBA season. There was question before last season as to whether or not we're going to play these games. Are we going to play on time? How many games are we going to play? Teams coming off the bubble, not 100%. They go through last season anyway. You get into last year's playoffs, a lot of injuries across the board. Injuries running rampant. Look at Phoenix in particular. They played the Clippers last year. Kawhi Leonard was not in that series. Had a torn ACL versus Utah in the semifinals. Now you're dealing with Paul George and Terrence Mann and guys like that. Terrence Mann, all due respect, is not Kawhi Leonard. I mean, these things happen every NBA playoffs. You're going to catch a break every now and then. Injuries are part of the game. But I don't know. For me personally, I question this. Like, Phoenix and Milwaukee. I know Milwaukee has the excuse of saying we didn't have Middleton. Phoenix really has no excuse. But how good were these teams really? And in particular, Phoenix. Milwaukee won a championship last year. They get more of a benefit of a doubt. Phoenix, on the other hand, you lost. You came back this season cocky, arrogant, full of yourselves, thinking it was just going to be a red carpet being rolled out to you to just walk and stroll, a leisurely stroll into this year's NBA Finals because you almost won it last year. The Suns came into this season with an approach that reminded me of the 2020 49ers. And me being me, I got to work the 49ers into every conversation I ever have with anyone about anything. But Phoenix reminded me of the 49ers of 2020. You got to the championship. You almost won. The Suns had a 2-0 lead. The 49ers were up 20-10 in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl against the Kansas City Chiefs. You almost won a championship. You were right there. And then you lost. You didn't win. You came up short. You failed. You couldn't get the job done. So you roll into next season thinking, from the 49ers' perspective, we're going to begin this 2020 NFL season in the fourth quarter of Super Bowl 54, and the NFL is going to give us a 10-point lead with 7.5 minutes to go, and we're just going to get a do-over, a mulligan. We're going to get another opportunity to try this again, and this time hopefully finish it. Phoenix, same mentality. Came into this season thinking, we're going to go back to the NBA Finals, and we're going to be up 2-0. All we got to do this time is just close it out and finish it and not blow and choke away a 2-0 series lead. And unfortunately, it didn't work out for them. It's a new NBA. It's a brand new NBA in more ways than one. Not only the reliance on the three-point shot, but the fact that the era of the super teams appears to be over. Look at Brooklyn. Look at Los Angeles. Look at Philadelphia, who I'm about to get to in a little bit. All these teams trying to manufacture a championship team, trying to put together a championship team under dubious circumstances. Just bring in X fill-in-the-blank all-star, this all-star player, that all-star player. All these friends join forces. We're going to link together all these all-star players who are somewhere in their 30s, and we're going to chase a championship that no longer works in today's NBA. And it's produced an era of parity in the modern-day NBA. So many teams right now are good enough to win a championship. The four teams that are still remaining, Golden State, Dallas, Miami, Boston, all four of those teams have a legitimate chance to win a championship this season. All four of those teams are good enough. There's no real juggernaut. There's no dominant team in today's current NBA. All four of these teams are kind of on the same level. And there's so many similarities between all four of these teams. They're guard heavy. They're wing heavy. They got a lot of guys between 6'4 and 6'8 or 6'9 that are quality basketball players, that are versatile basketball players that can play multiple positions. Because as we all know, the modern game of basketball is a positionless game. But you have these teams right now that can guard the perimeter, 3-and-D kind of players. Across all four of these teams, that's how you win in the modern-day NBA. And also draft picks, establishing a culture, getting some guys from the G League, building from within. That's what works in today's NBA. And that has produced an NBA where everything is up for grabs and no one's really in the driver's seat. There's about four, I would say maybe six, seven teams total who have a legitimate shot of winning a championship coming into a season now. Because the era of the super team is over, and now it's about building a real legitimate basketball team, establishing a culture, and just trying to grow organically as a franchise, as an organization. So when Phoenix comes into this season arrogant and cocky and full of themselves and pretentious and thinking we're just going to walk right back to the NBA Finals, it doesn't work that way. And this was a Phoenix team that this season faced no real adversity. They were the dominant team from the very beginning, from the giddy-up. They were beating people down, blowing teams out all season. They were the front runners, the number one team. They faced no real adversity this season until the semifinal series against Dallas. That was the first real hardship they had to endure the entire season, and they crumbled and they folded, and they couldn't hold up. And Devin Jenner couldn't answer the call. So for me, when I look at the playoff departure of both Phoenix and Milwaukee, two teams that were in last year's NBA Finals, it makes me ask the question out loud, were both of those teams kind of a fluke last season? I don't know, but I do think it's a question and a topic worth talking about. Jason Tatum, top five player in the NBA, give him all the flowers he can possibly receive. He's the man right now. That's a guy who studied Kobe Bryant and can actually apply it. This is a brother who, in his young NBA career, he has stared down some of the stiffest, toughest, most hardest challenges in the NBA as a young dude in this league. Under the age of 25, he's gone toe-to-toe with prime LeBron James, Kevin Durant, and Giannis Antetokounmpo has beaten two out of three of those guys in the playoffs. He outplayed Kevin Durant in the first round versus Brooklyn. He outplayed Giannis Antetokounmpo in this series in the semifinals against Milwaukee. Game six, season on the line, closeout game on the road in Milwaukee. Jason Tatum was on a different planet. Third and fourth quarter, timely buckets, pull-up threes, in the post. The footwork, the skill level on full display. Tatum and Luka Doncic, the aforementioned Luka Doncic, are two of the most skilled players in the NBA. And as a basketball fan, it's a joy and a privilege to watch both of these men operate. Two of the top five players in the NBA. And Jason Tatum in this series proved his worth. He proved his value in this series. He's one of those guys. If you didn't believe it before, you should definitely believe it now. Jason Tatum is one of those guys. In the NBA playoffs, we find out who's really about this life and who is just a pretender. Who's really an upper echelon player in this league and who is just all hype and all talk? The answers to those questions get found out yearly on an annual basis in the NBA playoffs. So that was today, Sunday. The two game sevens, Phoenix and Milwaukee, your two teams that made last year's NBA Finals, are gone. Dallas and the Boston Celtics move on, where they will face in the NBA Conference Finals the Golden State Warriors and the Miami Heat, respectively. Boston and Miami in the East, Golden State and Dallas in the West. Game 6 out here in the California Bay Area, San Francisco, the brand new Chase Center. It was the local, for me anyway, the hometown Golden State Warriors moving on. Big win over the Memphis Grizzlies without Ja Morant. However, to those people, I would say, the people who are saying already, the people who hate Golden State so much, are saying that the only reason they won is because Ja got hurt. They were up 2-1 with Ja Morant on the court. They destroyed Memphis in game 4 by like 30 points, and he was on the floor. Then you got the people who say, well, the only way Golden State can win is if someone on the other team, a good player, gets hurt. And they intentionally and deliberately took out Ja Morant in this series. So usually guys on a basketball court, typically, two players running into each other and knocking knees, that's commonplace. That happens. That's what happened to Ja Morant in game 4. He knocked knees with Klay Thompson, and that caused a deep bone bruise in his knee, and he had to miss the rest of the series. It's unfortunate. He's a great player. I enjoy watching him play. The series lost a little bit of his luster without Ja Morant. You wish that he was on the court. You always wish that the great players can remain on the court so that you don't have these discrepancies and controversies after a series is over, where there's a section of the fan base or people who are just anti the team that won, saying that the only reason they won is because fill in the blank superstar player got hurt. Shit happens. It's basketball. There are guys in the Golden State Warriors that are hurt right now. James Wiseman hasn't played at all this season. Gary Payton Jr. has a broken elbow. People can laugh at that and say, well, that's only Gary Payton Jr. He's a great perimeter defender. He's a key guy in what Golden State likes to do. So his absence hurts their team. Andre Iguodala, even at this age, his absence hurts that basketball team. Golden State's playing minus a lot of great players, a lot of very good players, I should say. As I said earlier, this is the NBA playoffs. It's the month of May. No one's really 100%. Injuries are a part of the game. Shit happens. It would be ridiculous for me, I think it's ridiculous for anyone, to say that the only reason Golden State won this series is because they deliberately injured Ja Morant. As if Jordan Poole has the hammer of God attached to his right arm, and his hand is that strong, it was able to cause a deep bone bruise on Ja Morant's knee by simply touching and grabbing at it. I refuse to believe that. To me, that's complete horseshit. Memphis did not lose that series under chicanerous circumstances. They lost that series fair and square. Golden State was the better basketball team. Even without Ja Morant in game 5, the Memphis Grizzlies whooped that trick and completely destroyed and decimated, annihilated, fucking abused the Golden State Warriors in game 5 of that series without Ja Morant. And they were 20-5 this season without Ja Morant on the floor in the regular season. Go back to the Bay. I had a feeling it was going to be over in 6. Because my thought process was, Golden State, it's a must-win game for them. They have to win game 6. If you don't, all the stories, all the talk, all the shit from the past is going to come up. about you blowing a 3-1 lead in the NBA Finals against the Cleveland Cavaliers in 2016. All that talk is going to come back and be thrown up in your face. Oh, remember the last time Golden State had a 3-1 lead? They blew it. You had to take care of business. Game 6, Klay. Klay Thompson in Game 6 should be an unlocked character in Mortal Kombat. He is unfuckwittable. 11 of 22 from the field, 8 of 14 from 3, 30 points, 8 rebounds. Game 6, Klay, the best player on the court for the Golden State Warriors. And he had been struggling throughout that series. Make no mistake about it. He had some games where he couldn't throw a softball. He couldn't throw a penny in the ocean. Sitting on the dock of the bay with Otis Redding, he couldn't throw a penny in the bay. He was awful. Missing shots. Lapses in judgment. Traveling violations for Klay Thompson. Missing free throws. Doing things that are uncharacteristic to Klay Thompson. Poor shot selection. Rushing himself. Being out of control at certain points in the series. Golden State as a team, as a collective, out of control. A lot of turnovers. Just mishandling the basketball. They played themselves. They almost played themselves to a Game 7. Even in Game 6, the game they won, they still had a lot of turnovers. They were still very careless with the basketball. Steph Curry, first and foremost in that. Got to call it as I see it. That's my favorite player in the NBA. I'm a Steph Curry fan. A lot of times throughout that series, a lot of bullshit basketball coming from him. Mishandling the basketball and, like I said, being very careless with the basketball. Unforced errors. Unforced turnovers. Not even like, you can't even really give Memphis credit for playing great defense. It was just Golden State being careless. Golden State trying things out. Maybe not respecting the competition. Maybe looking down on Memphis because they didn't have Ja Morant. I don't know what it was, but there was a lot of basketball, a lot of times in this series where Golden State was just very loose and carefree and just up and down and not really mentally focused and locked in. This was a very contentious series. You have Memphis complaining about Jordan Poole's, you know, touching of Ja Morant's knee and trying to accuse him of deliberately trying to injure Ja Morant. You have the Gary Payton injury in Game 2. You have the Draymond Green foul on Brandon Clark in Game 1 where he got tossed out the game for a flagrant 2 for grabbing his jersey but at the same time trying to hold him up before he fell to the ground. A lot of ticky-tack bullshit. Emotions running high. A lot of animus between both these basketball teams. And you have the dynamic of this young, up-and-coming Memphis Grizzly team versus the old elder statesman, the accomplished, the champion, Golden State Warriors, a 3-time NBA champion who appeared in 5 consecutive NBA finals. Is this going to be that passing of the torch? Not yet. Slow it down, pump the brakes, maybe next season. But right now, Golden State is still the elite team to beat in the Western Conference. Once they got all their guys back, once they got healthy, once Klay came back, once Draymond came back, the emergence of Jordan Poole and Steph Curry being Steph Curry, even with the turnovers, even with the inefficiency from the field, he still scored a lot of points. He still made timely buckets in the fourth quarter. A lot of people look at the box score and say, well, Steph was like 10 of 27. But when did he make those 10? At what point in the game did those 10 buckets occur, or the majority of those 10 buckets occur? If he made a couple of threes in the fourth quarter, I don't care about him being 10 or 27. In a close, tightly contested game, if you score 8 or 10 points of your 29 or 30 in the fourth quarter, I don't care how terribly you shot in the first three quarters. That means nothing to me. I saw Kobe and Jordan have a lot of games where they were awful from the field, but in the fourth quarter, when it mattered most, game time, winning time, they were right there. They showed improved. Curry, to me, is on that same level. Curry might play bad quarters 1 through 3. In the fourth quarter, throughout the entire Memphis series, I thought Steph Curry was locked in. I thought Steph Curry played beautiful basketball in the fourth quarters of the pivotal deciding games in that series. Games, pretty much all the games Golden State won. Games 1, 3, 4, and 6, Steph Curry played lights-out basketball in the fourth quarter when it mattered the most. And that, to me, that's the most important. That's the most important thing. And then you got to consider the other guys, or as Shaquille O'Neal always calls them, the others, the role players, the guys who don't get the post-game news conferences, the guys who don't have the endorsement deals, who are not on television every fucking 5 minutes or so, as Steph Curry is right now with the Subway commercials and the Crypto.com commercials and so on and so forth. the guys who were under the radar and no one really talks about, Kevon Looney, 22 rebounds. Great adjustment by interim head coach Mike Brown, the new head coach of the Sacramento Kings, filling in for Steve Kerr, who's out with COVID. A great adjustment by Mike Brown starting Kevon Looney because Golden State needed some more size. Memphis was killing Golden State with Jaren Jackson and Steven Adams emerging in this series. I won't say emerging, but able to play. He was out for the first, I think, two games. He was on the COVID list himself. So Memphis is able to bring in Steven Adams and pair him with Jaren Jackson. That pretty much did offset the loss of Ja Morant because now you have a dominant presence in the paint. And you can control the series and dominate on the boards and out-rebound them and everything else and protect the rim. Golden State's biggest weakness is their lack of size. Well, you got Kevon Looney, 6'9", maybe 6'10", on a good day. You can start him and see what he can do. He's been on the team for a couple of years. He knows what needs to be done. He understands that Golden State system, and it worked out perfectly. He had 22 rebounds in Game 6. They out-rebounded Memphis 70-44 in Game 6. A lot of guys for Golden State, Kuminga as well. A lot of guys for the Warriors stepped up and really answered the challenge and played a little bit outside of their roles, but did what needed to be done to help the team move forward and advance. It's a team effort, and Golden State is a nice thing going on right now. Even as a Laker fan, I respect and appreciate what the Golden State Warriors are doing. I'm envious, really, because they do things the right way, organically. The top three players in the team, three guys who were destined for the Pro Basketball Hall of Fame one day, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, those are draft picks. They drafted those three guys. They built them up organically. They did this the right way. They did this the way the Lakers used to do shit. They drafted people. They developed them. They groomed them. And they reaped the benefits of that. I have no, even as a Laker fan, I have no issue with the Golden State Warriors. Curry's my favorite player. I'm a Klay Thompson fan. Draymond's all right with me. I enjoy watching them play. They play beautiful basketball. They play the game the way the game is supposed to be played. I have no problem with the Golden State Warriors. So congratulations to them for making the Western Conference Final. What is this now, like the sixth time since 2015? Like I said, five consecutive NBA Finals earlier. And now this, taking a two-year break basically, trying to get the band back together with Klay going through an ACL and an Achilles and Draymond and his injury problems and the team kind of in flux for the past 2 years. And now here they are back on the center stage, back in the Western Conference Finals. Hey, good on them, man. Congratulations and good luck to them. Dallas is not going to be an easy team to get rid of. That's going to be a fight, a back-and-forth battle. I'm calling it – I'm not going to call a winner just yet. I'll do that later on this week. But I'm going to say that series is destined to go 6-7 games. I won't call it in 5. I'm damn sure not going to call it a sweep. I'm saying whoever I pick to win, I'm leaning towards Golden State, but I think it's going to be 6-7 games. Luka's the coldest motherfucker on the planet right now. Spencer Dinwiddie was a hell of a trade for the Dallas Mavericks. That was a crazy good trade. One of those trades went under the radar. But you lose Porzingis, not really a big loss. You bring in Spencer Dinwiddie, that's a big gain right there. With Brunson, with Finney Smith, you know, the whole team dynamic. Jason Kidd's the head coach, really emphasizing defense for that team. And they're just a good basketball team, especially at home. That's going to be a dogfight of a Western Conference Final. And in the Eastern Conference Final, you have the Miami Heat taking on the Boston Celtics. The Miami Heat advanced to the Conference Final for the sixth time under the stewardship of Eric Spoelstra. Remember, four consecutive Conference Finals appearances with LeBron and D-Wade and Bosh. And then you dismantle the entire team. LeBron goes to Cleveland. D-Wade gets older and goes to Chicago and then Cleveland. A cup of coffee in Cleveland, then comes back to Miami to finish out his career, but not quite the player that he once was. Obviously, Chris Bosh, medical problems, retired him earlier, blood clots in his lungs and everything else, heart problems. So that whole thing blows up. But Miami, because they have culture and consistency and continuity and cohesion, are able to rebuild from the ground up and emerge out the darkness and the shadows and still put together a competitive basketball team capable of challenging for a championship. It's very impressive what they've done down there in Miami and South Beach. Pat Riley overseeing the entire operation. But Eric Spoelstra, give him his flowers. This is a guy, in my opinion, I think Eric Spoelstra is the best coach in the NBA right now. I really believe that. I think Eric Spoelstra is the number one coach in all of basketball right now. With all due apologies to Monty Williams of Phoenix and Nick Nurse in Toronto, you got Greg Popovich in San Antonio, a living legend, an all-time great NBA basketball coach. But I think right now it's Eric Spoelstra because he's been the coach throughout that entire time. From the big three and that four-year run to blowing it up in the middle of it and then resurrecting the whole thing with a brand new cast of characters with Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo and Tyler Hero, PJ Tucker, Duncan Robinson, Victor Oladipo, Dwayne Dedmon, bringing in all these different guys and throwing them all together and still being a competitive championship caliber basketball team. A lot of respect has to be given to Eric Spoelstra and that Miami Heat organization for the way they conduct their business. And they took care of the Philadelphia 76ers 4-2 with a 99-90 victory in Game 6 on the road in the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Enough of all the preliminaries. Let's just get straight to the fucking point. Let's get straight to the James Harden slander and disrespect. James Harden, as a basketball player, is like a deadbeat father. He's that guy that goes out to the local liquor store for a pack of Newport's Boss 100 and a fifth of Kentucky Gentleman, and then his family never sees him for another 2 years. It took him 2 years to go get those cigarettes and that cheap-ass alcohol. That's James Harden, this deadbeat and derelict on his duties. You're supposed to be a great basketball player. You're supposed to be an upper echelon, top-tier, elite NBA player and scorer. There are people who went on television and said that you were the third best shooting guard of all time. There were people who went on television and said that you and Joel Embiid as a collective are on par with Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal. People said this out loud. People actually fixed their lips to say this obnoxious bullshit. People said this, that James Harden and Joel Embiid are the modern day Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal. Shut the fuck up. Are you fucking kidding me right now? Are you serious? The third best shooting guard of all time. People said James Harden is a better scorer than both Kobe and Michael. Whoa. This same guy that consistently, perpetually chokes, fails, and shits the bed every year in the playoffs. This guy who quits on multiple teams. This guy that asked for all-star teammate after all-star teammate and got all-star teammate after all-star teammate. This guy's played with Kevin Durant twice, Russell Westbrook twice, Chris Paul, Dwight Howard, and now Joel Embiid and Kyrie Irving before that in Brooklyn. He's played with a litany of all-star players. They've built teams around him in Houston and in Brooklyn. He was a part of a big three, but he didn't want to be there anymore, so he asked for a trade, or he made rumblings behind the scenes that he wanted a trade. So Brooklyn obliged him and dealt him to a division rival in the Atlantic Division in the NBA Eastern Conference. They traded him to the Philadelphia 76ers for Ben Simmons and Seth Curry and some other players or whatever. This was a trade that so far nobody won. Both teams lost that trade. Brooklyn got Ben Simmons, and Ben Simmons at some point in the past year and a half injured his back to the point that he couldn't play basketball for the Brooklyn Nets. No one knows how, when, where, or if it happened, but it did happen apparently. He had a back injury. He recently allegedly had back surgery, and he couldn't play. He talked about playing in Game 3, didn't play in Game 3. Then the conversation was he's going to come back in Game 4. That didn't happen. He didn't play for the Brooklyn Nets, and they got swept out of the NBA playoffs by the Boston Celtics. James Harden might as well have not played. They brought him in to replace Ben Simmons because Ben Simmons was too scared to shoot the basketball last year versus the Atlanta Hawks. Ben Simmons was too much of a coward to go up at the rim when the only man there at the rim to contest him was Trae Young, who's maybe 6'1 or 6'2 at most, at best. And Ben Simmons is 6'10, 6'11, 7 feet, much bigger than Trae Young. And he was too much of a coward, too pussy, to go to the rim and dunk it. Another guy affiliated with that Jenner Kardashian bullshit. Do you see a trend here? Because I do. Ben Simmons was afraid to shoot the basketball last year. James Harden's never been afraid to shoot the basketball. That's his M.O. That's his number one attribute. Shoot the basketball. You're a scorer. We, at the very least, we know he's not going to give us anything defensively. We know he's not going to do too much outside of shooting and scoring and facilitating the offense. But we know he's at least going to attempt jump shots. He might fail in the playoffs, as he has a propensity to do. He might choke. He might come up short. But we know he's at least going to take shots. In the second half, in Game 6 versus Miami, James Harden attempted 2 shots. Drunk white girls at the bar took more shots on Thursday than James Harden did in the second half of Game 6 versus the Miami Heat. 2 field goal attempts for a guy who's known to score the basketball, at least he does in the regular season. All those 59-point triple-doubles with the Houston Rockets that turned into absolute nothing in May in pivotal playoff games and series versus Golden State, versus the Clippers, versus whoever they were playing, the Lakers in 2020. This guy's a fraud. He's a phony, a big fat phony. He's always been a phony. He's always been a fraud. Consistent playoff fuck-ups. I said this on the last podcast. I'm waiting for the annual James Harden collapse in the NBA playoffs. It was glorious. It was fun to watch. I take so much pride. I revel so much in James Harden's failures because as a basketball player, I just don't respect him. I don't think he takes his craft serious enough. He appears to be fat and out of shape most of the time. I don't think he really puts as much into the game as he probably should have. And for people to say that he's a better scorer than Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan, as a longtime NBA basketball fan, I take offense to that. Kobe and Michael put the work in. Kobe and Michael were the first ones in and the last ones out. There are numerous guys who have told stories about they tried to get a head start on the day by going to the gym early in the morning at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, trying to get an upper hand, get an advantage on everyone else. And they got there, and Kobe Bryant was already there. Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade tell these stories about their time playing for the USA, for the Olympic team, playing on Team USA. They tried to get a head start on the day, try to get early advantage, a leg up on the competition by going to the gym and trying to get some shots up, trying to work up a sweat. By the time they got there, Kobe Bryant's already there. That's the work ethic that Kobe had. That's the work ethic that Jordan had. That's the work ethic that James Harden does not have. So don't ever compare him or say that he's a better scorer, a better individual scorer than either Michael Jordan or Kobe Bean Bryant. To me, that's disrespectful. That's insulting. That's a slap in the fucking face. Show me the playoff game where Michael Jordan only attempted 2 shots in the second half and was held scoreless. This dude can't play anymore. He can't blow past people. He has no burst. All that dancing he does on the perimeter doesn't work anymore. No one's fooled by that. He had 2 ridiculous turnovers in this game. He threw the ball away to Bam Adebayo and jogged back on defense, a brisk, leisurely stroll back on defense as if I don't really care. This don't mean shit to me. When the game's over, I'm going to go to the nearest strip club. I'm going to party and hang out with Travis Scott and Meek Mill. I don't fucking care about this. I got other shit going on. You're going to turn the ball over and be that lazy getting back on defense? Kobe and Michael? Nah. Clyde Drexler, the most disrespected superstar of all time, perhaps. Clyde Drexler is a better shooting guard than James Harden ever was. Reggie Miller is better. Jerry West is better. The number of guys better at that position than James Harden. It's ridiculous to say he's the third best shooting guard of all time. After all these playoff failures, how much more evidence do we need to see? Philadelphia brought you in for moments like this, and you only attempt 2 shots. For all that, they could have kept Ben Simmons. You look at the amount of games Harden had where he didn't score 25 points, like going back to the regular season, it's astounding. It's double digits. I want to say it's about 14 to 15 consecutive games where he failed to score 25 or more points. Joel Embiid in the postgame flat out, in a lot of people's eyes, threw him under the bus by saying, you know, this is not the same James Harden that you're used to. This is not Houston James Harden. This is a different guy. He's a facilitator of the offense. I would answer that by saying, well, Houston James Harden wasn't very good in the playoffs either. I mean, that's a fair statement to say. Look at the numbers. Harden only averaged 21 points per game during the regular season. His field goal percentage of 40.2 and three-point percentage 32.6, career lows. Now, to be fair, he did have 22 and 15 in a game 6 against Toronto in a closeout game, and he had 36 points in game 4 of this series, a game that Philadelphia won. But he also had 22 shots in the last two games, scored only 25 points combined in those last two games, had nearly as many turnovers, 8, as assists, 13. He was garbage. There's no other way to put it. He was complete garbage in games 5 and 6 when it all mattered the most, when the season was on the line. He wasn't there. Deadbeat father. He went out to the store and got a pack of Newport Boss 100s and a fifth of Kentucky Gentleman with the season on the line. Deadbeat father, James Harden. Deadbeat basketball player. And now the 76ers are faced with a conundrum. Do you want to pay this guy a max contract? Because when they signed him in February, when they made that sign and trade, remember, Daryl Morey is a GM or player, president, whatever, with the Philadelphia 76ers, formerly of the Houston Rockets. He's the guy that made that deal to bring in Harden from OKC, and Harden blossomed into an MVP, consistent player, one of the top 5 or 10 players in the NBA on a regular basis, in the regular season especially. He was a great player, won an MVP for the Houston Rockets. Great player for them. So Morey is very fond of James Harden as a basketball player. He's with Philadelphia now, but coming off of this kind of playoff appearance or this kind of playoff performance, does it warrant paying James Harden max money? Weighs 33, doesn't take care of his body, is not really in the best of shape, is fat, is lazy, wants to hang out with rappers and be a part of the nightlife and go to titty bars and strip clubs as opposed to working out, eating right, getting the proper amount of sleep, taking care of his body, yada, yada, yada. Do you want to reward that guy with a max contract? On Philadelphia, that's a resounding hell no. That's a no on so many levels. That's a negative no. In no way, shape, or form, if I'm Daryl Morey or anybody else affiliated with the 76er organization, I'm not giving him a max contract. I might let him go. But I think he has a player option. He can opt back in for next season. I don't see him going anywhere. The thought process was, he's going to be paired with Joel Embiid and have something that he never had in Houston, a quality big man to take responsibility and pressure off of his shoulders, open things up, and make it easier for him to produce. But at this stage of his career, he appears to be washed, or at least a player on decline. That burst, that first step, not there anymore. The ball handling doesn't mesmerize people anymore. He's not shaking people to the ground like he once was. He's not getting himself wide open. A step back three isn't falling the way it used to. He's not the same player anymore. So can you really justify giving that kind of dude at this juncture of his career a max contract? I would have a hard time doing that. Actually, I wouldn't have a hard time. To me, it's an open and shut case. I would not do it. I would not pay him max money for the kind of player that he is right now. He was not the only problem that Philadelphia had in game 6. Joel Embiid, 7 of 24, 20 points in a closeout game. I know Embiid's banged up. I know he's hurt, got a broken face. He was in concussion protocol, missed the first two games of this series, got a bad wrist that's going to need surgery now in the offseason. But yet and still, that shouldn't influence your decision-making or your approach to playing basketball. I'm watching game 6. And I'm flat out disgusted because I'm watching the guy that's 7 feet tall, 280 pounds, float around the perimeter and take perimeter jump shots and threes and play soft against a team that was playing a small ball lineup the majority of the game, in particular the second half. Miami had P.J. Tucker at the 5 the majority of the second half. P.J. Tucker is 6 feet, 5 inches tall. That's tall for regular folks. It's short on the NBA court. Joel Embiid, as I already said, 7 feet tall, 280 pounds. Get on the low block and punish these motherfuckers for trying to play you with a small lineup where the tallest man on their team on the court right now is 6 feet, 5 inches tall. Punish them. Embarrass them. Make them regret that. There's no excuse for Embiid to be on the perimeter. Yeah, I know he can make those shots. I just hate to see it. As an old school basketball fan who has a certain approach mentally to the game, there's certain things I see in the modern day NBA that make no sense to me. And number one, top of that list, is when I see a guy who's big enough, strong enough, tall enough to dominate on the interior, who who instead chooses to be on the perimeter, on the exterior, and try to be a guard. You're not 6'4". You're 7 feet. Act like it. I look at Embiid, Towns, a few other guys, same way. Stop fucking around on the perimeter. Get on the low block and handle your business. You're being guarded by a man that's 6'5". This should be light work for you. But, I mean, Embiid, I think he's deserving of some of the blame. But to me, the biggest scapegoat in all this, the biggest problem in all this is James Harden, not even Doc Rivers. You know, you can't say Doc blew a 3-1 lead this time, right? When you're down 2-0, you can't blow a 3-1 lead. So maybe that's him thinking, being more progressive about the situation, but I can't really put too much of the blame on Doc Rivers. I'm not sure what he had to work with. I'm not sure what he really had to work with. You have Embiid, who was less than 100%, like I already said a couple times already. It's the playoffs. Nobody's really healthy. James Harden, as far as I knew, had no injuries. He was healthy, and he didn't show up. He was a deadbeat father in this series. And I'm not sure what Doc Rivers was supposed to do to make him play better. They ran some offensive sets to get him in advantageous positions to score. He just couldn't do it. He just couldn't do it. It's not there anymore. Meanwhile, Jimmy Butler on the other end was fantastic. He was awesome. He was amazing. He played the way a star player is supposed to play in these kind of situations. 32 points, 8 rebounds, 13 to 29 shooting. I don't care about that. You scored 32 points and your team won the game. They were up at different points in this game by about 19, 20 points or whatever. So that final score is not really indicative of what kind of game this was. Philadelphia got blown out. Philadelphia got outplayed. Game 5 was a complete massacre, a slaughter. When the series was tied at 2, that's embarrassing to go on the road and get beat down the way they did and come back home and lay down the way they did. I mean, Philadelphia has had so many postseason failures in the semifinals. It's embarrassing. This is a team talking about trust the process. You know, you tanked for all those years to get those high draft picks, and you end up with Jahlil Okafor and Markelle Fultz and Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. Fast forward to right now, only one of those guys is still on your roster. The other three are gone. Markelle Fultz didn't work out. Injuries, inconsistency, down in Orlando. Ben Simmons traded to Brooklyn. Didn't want to play there anymore. Jahlil Okafor was a relic. Jahlil Okafor is one of those guys. He should have been born 10 years early. He would have fit in great with the NBA in the late 90s, 2000s. Coming into the league in the 2010s when the game was starting to shift to a more perimeter-based three-point shooting game, his game became completely outdated. Embiid's the only one from that process, from that 4 or 5 year run of tanking and losing on purpose to try to get high draft picks. Embiid's the only one that panned out. And even he has had injury problems, failures in the playoffs, gotten hurt every year in the playoffs, had some bad games and elimination games. Let's just call it what it is. Trusting the process in Philadelphia didn't work. Hasn't worked yet, probably won't work as presently constituted. Hasn't worked and probably won't work. Give credit to the Miami Heat for making it happen. Give credit to them for developing and finding a guy like Max Strus, who I never heard of until a couple of months ago. He had 20 points in Game 6. He outplayed James Harden. A guy named Max Strus outplayed James Harden. Think about that for a second. A dominating performance by the Heat, I should say, over the 76ers, moving on. I'm looking forward very much to both conference finals. I was looking forward more to a Phoenix and Golden State conference final. That didn't happen. They didn't show up, and they got massacred and sent closer to God by the Dallas Mavericks. Now you got a Warriors-Mavericks Western Conference final. It's kind of like a 49er and Cowboy NFC Championship game. Bay Area versus Dallas, Texas. Kind of the same dynamic, so that's pretty cool, I guess. Eastern Conference, Boston and Miami. These two teams have met before. When LeBron was still there in Miami, there were some classic battles between Boston and Miami in the Eastern Conference Finals, with LeBron and Paul Pierce going mano a mano, having a duel in Game 7 at the TD Bank Garden or whatever the fuck it's called nowadays. So a lot of playoff history that exists between those two teams. Two teams with a great culture and a great understanding of how they want to play basketball and the kind of people they want to bring in to play basketball the way they want to play it. This is modern day NBA basketball. If you can shoot threes better than the other team, if you have great wing players, 3-and-D guys, that's how you win. And you look at Boston and Miami, mirror images of each other. There are a lot of guys that correlate with what I'm saying. They got a lot of guys on their team, 6'4 through 6'8, 6'9, that are versatile, that can do a lot of different things on the court. Great players, can shoot it, can defend. This is going to be a fun series. I think it's going to go 7 games, leaning towards Boston, so far right now anyway. Going to be a great series on both ends, East and West. Fun to watch, good basketball. I love this time of year. I love the NBA playoffs because we separate the real from the fake and we find out who's about this life and who just wants to take selfies on Instagram. This is all good with me. So that's my recap of the second round of the NBA playoffs. Congratulations to the teams moving forward. And for the teams that lost, seasons come to an end only so long fake teams can pretend. Via con Dios to you, my friend. Season's over. Enjoy Cancun. We hope to see you again very soon. And with all that being said, that concludes this episode of the Deion Gordon Podcast. Always humble, eternally grateful, very much appreciative. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, picture me rolling. I'm out.